Hi, I'm Keri Phillips. Thanks for downloading this Rear Vision podcast. Last week we heard about the Troubles, 30 years of sectarian violence in Northern Ireland. This time, the Good Friday Agreement. It's a deal many thought couldn't be made. On its 20th anniversary, just how successful has it been?
I said when I arrived here on Wednesday night that I felt the hand of history upon us. Today I hope that the burden of history can at long last start to be lifted from our shoulders.
And today is about the promise of a bright future, a day when we hope a line can be drawn under the bloody past.
Tony Blair and Bertie Ahern, then the Prime Ministers of Britain and Ireland. 20 years ago, the Good Friday Agreement brought an uneasy end to the troubles in Northern Ireland. As we heard last week, the conflict between the Catholic, largely nationalist community and the Unionist Protestant majority was driven by the disputed status of the six counties of Northern Ireland. Republicans saw themselves in a war to unite an independent Ireland, while Loyalists defended what they saw as their right to remain part of the United Kingdom. Both sides ran paramilitary organisations, and the violence also embroiled the British Army and the police, the Royal Ulster Constabulary. However, after 30 years of bombing, kidnapping and murder, and over 3,500 deaths, it seemed a peace deal might be possible. John Tong is Professor of British and Irish Politics at the University of Liverpool.
The first thing that was needed was an IRA ceasefire. And that was a fragile entity because the IRA called a ceasefire in 1994 after the British and Irish governments had introduced the Downing Street Declaration, which sort of outlined the broad framework of what peace might look like and what the politics of that peace might look like. The IRA called a ceasefire in 1994 on the grounds that they would be admitted to peace talks and be part of the solution. When they weren't admitted to those peace talks, the IRA ceasefire collapsed, and some of the biggest bombs that the IRA ever detonated went off in London and Manchester in 1996. Then Tony Blair became UK Prime Minister in 1997, and he was determined that the IRA and its political arm, Sinn Féin, would be part of the peace process. So Blair demanded another IRA ceasefire, which was duly restored, but he dropped the idea that the IRA would have to decommission all its weapons in advance of any peace deal. And what you saw was the IRA holding on to its weapons whilst the Good Friday Agreement was struck. And we shouldn't pretend that all the parties were signed up to the Good Friday Agreement. The largest party in Northern Ireland today, the Democratic Unionist Party, from the Protestant Unionist British tradition, they never signed up to the Good Friday Agreement. They walked out of the exit door as soon as Sinn Féin arrived at the entrance for the talks that Blair had initiated. So it was never a deal that satisfied everyone in Northern Ireland. But nonetheless, there was sufficiency of consensus to move towards an agreement. I think there were a number of reasons why the Good Friday Agreement came about. I think the first thing was that the IRA realised they could not enforce a united Ireland by violence. I think the second aspect was war weariness on all sides. No one wanted another generation to go through the horrors that the previous generation in Northern Ireland had experienced. I think other factors were an international awareness and greater international intervention. In particular, I'd highlight the role of Bill Clinton as United States president, who was pretty active during the peace process. And of course, the United States was involved in a very important brokerage role because Senator George Mitchell, the Democrat senator, he refereed the talks between the rival parties. Many said he would never, ever get a deal. He was skeptical himself when he arrived, but by a miracle, really, he said, first of all, there has to be an agreement by Easter 1998, otherwise these people could talk forever. And secondly, it was an agreement which has broadly, just about, and on a fragile basis, held.
Senator Mitchell had been sent to Northern Ireland 3 years earlier as a trade envoy, but he became involved in the peace talks and was ultimately asked by the British and Irish governments to chair the final negotiations.
It was very intense in the last 2 weeks. Keep in mind that the negotiations had gone on for nearly 2 years with very little progress. And then in February of that year, on a flight from Dublin back to the United States, I concluded that there had to be some kind of unbreakable early deadline to to force a decision. Otherwise, I thought the talks would either go on forever or would spiral downward. There was a lot of violence in the preceding weeks, and it looked like the whole thing was falling apart. So I conceived a plan to impose a deadline. I persuaded over a period of about a month and a half the two governments and all the political parties to join in it. And I established a sort of a schedule for those last 2 weeks, what it was we hoped to accomplish each day over a two-week period. And it was extremely intense trying to do that. We didn't reach every goal. We often failed by days to do something we had agreed to do. And over the last 48 or 72 hours, there was very little sleep. It was quite intense, sort of nonstop negotiation. Every issue is difficult, really, when you think about it. What happens with prisoners on both sides, Republicans and Loyalists, wanted release programs for prisoners. Many others were opposed to that. The issue of the decommissioning of weapons was absolutely difficult. It's how I got started in the first place there, what to do with them, how to handle decommissioning. Just about everything in the whole process was pretty emotional and difficult, and finally it sort of all came together. When I drafted the agreement, I tried to figure out a way to put enough in it for everyone to see themselves as having gained something, in the hope that that would enable them to swallow the parts that they didn't like, and that's kind of how it came out. We finally got it done over great difficulty and much anxiety.
The agreement was based upon power sharing between two rival enemies. The Protestant Unionist British tradition was obliged to share power with the Catholic Irish nationalist tradition. There were some add-ons to that, such as an all-Ireland dimension to satisfy Catholic Irish nationalists, and there was a British-Irish axis as well between London and Dublin. But the basis of the Good Friday Agreement at its heart was the idea that historic enemies would share power within political institutions, within a 108-member devolved Northern Ireland government. The idea that they would live happily ever after was always going to be fantasy, but the hope was that as historic enemies came to meet each other on a day-to-day basis across the Assembly chamber, that gradually things would thaw. There was various checks and balances put into the power-sharing arrangements. The basis of it was that neither community could dominate the other, so contentious legislation had to have the support within the devolved assembly of both communities. So there had to be support from at least 50% of nationalists and 50% of unionists in certain key decision-making. There wasn't a great historical rapprochement. The two communities didn't come to love each other in the assembly, and certainly not at their grassroots. But the idea was, on a pragmatic basis, there was a need for compromise. I mean, the Good Friday Agreement itself was a huge compromise, because Sinn Féin was not getting, nationalists were not getting, this holy grail of a united Ireland for which the IRA had fought for the best part of three decades. For unionists, there was lots of painful medicine associated with the Good Friday Agreement, such as the release of all IRA prisoners who were released within 2 years of the agreement, big changes to the police, which unionists tended to see as their police force, such as 50-50 Catholic and non-Catholic recruitment into the police to make it more representative. But within the devolved government itself, the idea was that you would put in a set of mutual vetoes and requirements for parallel consent for key legislation, so that we'd never go back to the bad old days of one community effectively governing the other.
Polls have closed in Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic, where people have been voting to approve or reject a historic peace deal.
In Northern Ireland, people were asked to approve the Stormont Agreement, which would set up a parliament where power would be shared between Protestant Unionists and Catholic Nationalists. In the Irish Republic, voters were asked to endorse changes to the Constitution, dropping Dublin's claim to Northern Ireland. In return, cross-border bodies will be set up, giving the Republic a limited say in the affairs of Northern Ireland for the first time.
A referendum in May produced an overwhelming vote in support of the agreement on both sides of the border, and the scene was now set for the establishment of a power-sharing government. Elections were held in June, but the failure to resolve the issue of the decommissioning of weapons was to prove an enormous problem.
Northern Ireland's fledgling experiment in inclusive government has come to a screeching halt after just 72 days, with London reimposing direct rule on the British province. The move, which was widely expected, follows the failure of the Irish Republican Army to disarm.
We've got to clear up this issue of decommissioning once and for all. It's dogged the process throughout. It has sapped confidence in the institutions, and we've really got to resolve it once and for all.
The early years of power sharing after the Good Friday Agreement were chaotic. The unionist tradition was demanding that the IRA get rid of all its weapons straight away. And so unionists only went into the power sharing government on condition that the IRA began decommissioning its weapons and told Sinn Féin to tell the IRA that. But the IRA was determined that it was not going to decommission its weapons quickly because that would look like surrender from the IRA's point of view. So what you got was chaos rather than stable power sharing between 1998 and 2005. The power sharing institutions collapsed in 2002 and they didn't return until 2007. So the Good Friday Agreement did not bring political stability to Northern Ireland. It didn't bring a perfect peace either. There were an average of more than 300 shootings and bombings per year after the Good Friday Agreement, but that was a lot lower. That was relative peace compared to what had gone on before. We didn't really get stable power sharing after the Good Friday Agreement until 2007, by which time the largest parties in Northern Ireland, in terms of their, you know, reflecting their community bases, were the Democratic Unionist Party, led by the hardline Protestant fundamentalist preacher Ian Paisley, and Sinn Féin, led by Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness. Once those two became the largest parties, then what happened was that from 2006-2007 onwards, they were prepared to do business, which astonished much of the world because Ian Paisley had spent his life denouncing Irish Republicans, denouncing the Catholic Church, denouncing, you know, all his opponents. No one thought that he would ever do a deal with Martin McGuinness, a self-confessed former commander of the IRA. So that was an absolute jaw-dropping deal that was agreed in 2006 with devolution restored in 2007. What followed, ironically, was a relatively stable period of power sharing between Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness, the leaders of the DUP and Sinn Féin, respectively. For a good few years after that, it was continued until the most recent collapse that we've had in 2017.
The problems with the implementation were that it was based on different readings of what people had agreed to.
Professor Fergal Cochrane is the director of the Conflict Analysis Research Centre at the University of Kent.
Now, this was called constructive ambiguity in diplomatic speak. And essentially what that meant was you would read various sections of it and you would read into that promises from the opposite side. So, for instance, the decommissioning of paramilitary weapons, that was a particularly tortuous paragraph in the agreement. And the Provisional IRA read that one way, unionists read it a different way, and then there was disagreement about what had been promised to whom. So, as a result of that, then mistrust creeped into the implementation of the agreement, and it took a lot longer to do. So it took a year, for instance, between the agreement being signed up to and the institutions actually arriving. The other issue, which quite a lot of people don't really see, because they just say, oh, well, there was an agreement, 71% of people voted for this agreement. But that masks the fact that even since 1998, Catholic nationalists were consistently more positive about this than the Protestant Unionist side. So half of the Protestant Unionist side weren't even signed up to the agreement. So Ian Paisley's Democratic Unionist Party were what's called spoilers in the agreement. They didn't accept it. And within that 71% vote, about 50% of the Unionist side rejected it, and about 90% of the Nationalist side accepted it. And ever since 1998, that has been maintained. And so there's always been a problem with getting unionist buy-in into the structures of the peace process. And that's been a continual issue, really. The agreement was based on this idea called parity of esteem. Parity of esteem between the British tradition and the Irish tradition. And parity of esteem goes right through the DNA of the peace process and the Good Friday Agreement. And the difficulty with that for unionists was that they felt that while they were happy to respect nationalism, that nationalism shouldn't be on a par with their Britishness. because Northern Ireland is legally British. So the concept that in some way Northern Ireland would be treated differently to the rest of the United Kingdom was a real problem for unionists. So, in other words, change the status quo looked to unionists like it was sort of going in the wrong direction, whereas changes to the status quo for nationalists were gains, essentially, for them. Even though, from a neutral perspective, you could say, well, you know, this is fair dues for both sides. Unionists felt that their Britishness was being in some way sort of compromised or diluted by this parity of esteem. And you can see it right until today with the Irish Language Act debate, for instance, that Northern Ireland is British, we should be treated exactly the same as the rest of the United Kingdom, and there shouldn't be two legal languages in Northern Ireland. It goes right back to this fundamental issue.
You're listening to Rear Vision with Keri Phillips on Radio National, RN. It's the 20th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, which largely brought an end to 30 years of violence in Northern Ireland. It didn't, however, bring an end to divisions within the community.
One of the problems of a political deal like the type you had in Northern Ireland was that no one actually says, and there's no time limit ever put on, how long you should treat politics as a battle between two rival communities. At what point would Northern Ireland reach the point where you wouldn't need to have these mutual vetoes, where you wouldn't need parallel consent, etc.? The unspoken question at the time was, when do we expect these differences to sort of biodegrade? And they haven't biodegraded at all. If you look at Northern Ireland now, there are more peace walls in place physically separating the communities than were there in 1998, the year the Good Friday Agreement was signed. The growth in integrated education is glacially slow. Culturally, the two communities are miles apart. And in issues such as Protestant Orange Order parades, there have been riots more years than not since the Good Friday Agreement over those parades. So this is not to be a naysayer about the agreement. It has produced a relative peace. There has been significant political progress, but the idea that the Good Friday Agreement was a mechanism for the reintegration of community divisions, I think we need to get away from. Northern Ireland's governance is all about equal recognition of two rival communities. Once upon a time, you'd be very, very fearful of straying into the wrong community. That fear element is gone, and you know there are discussions about removing the peace walls. It's just that no one has had the courage to do so far. I would argue that it's where you need to start. Dismantling the physical signs of division.
Tell us something about these walls. What exactly are they? What do they look like and where are they?
At the start of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, you had the biggest population shifts since the Second World War as Protestants fled to the safety of their own areas and Catholics fled to the safety of their own areas. There was already divisions in Belfast, but they weren't as acute as what you see today. And then because there were attacks upon some of those areas, streets burnt out in a few cases, local communities put up temporary, makeshift peace barriers, or peace walls as they became known, simply physical barriers to stop the other community attacking them. Rather than they be bulldozed or removed, as the troubles worsened and more people killed, those walls became ever higher. You know, at some point, they reached 100 feet in parts of Belfast, and they were extended, and they became routinized part of the landscape, you know, the ultimate testimony to how society is divided there. There have been, as I say, one or two ideas about bringing them down, and the devolved executive, when it was functioning, talked about a plan to bring them down by 2025. But frankly, there's only been two demolished so far, and in one other, there's a gate open so the communities can mix at weekends, but not at other times, which seems bizarre. Bizarrely, and perhaps perversely, they become tourist attractions. You know, people travel around Belfast now. The terror tourism has become part of the city's game. It's become a tourist staple. They go around and lots of tourists will write on these walls and hope for peace and write nice aspirations. But as I say, the closer you are in terms of the population to those communities, the more they want them to remain. So it's going to be a tough ask to actually bring them down.
Our religious and political affiliations felt as strongly among young people who didn't experience the worst of the troubles.
If you look at surveys, for instance, you'll find that people between the age of sort of 18 and 24 have a stronger preference for Northern Ireland identity over an Irish identity or a British identity. So in other words, there's a notion of a sort of a joint Northern Ireland project emerging amongst the young, and that they are much more concerned with the future of their education system, health service, social and economic priorities. So that's on one side of the equation. But if you look on the other side of the equation, there is no evidence from voting patterns that younger people are voting for more, what you might call more moderate options, like the Alliance Party, for instance. There seems to be still a lot of alignment between the unionist and nationalist 18 to 24 age group in terms of the way they vote. They vote in the old traditional manner. So there's conflicting signals there, you know. And also then if you look at things like, you know, when things get quite difficult in terms of particular spike points in sectarian relationships, obviously the marching season in July is one obvious one, that young people are still very set up to be in quite an oppositional sectarian relationship with each other. And part of the reason for that is because Northern Ireland is still a very structurally divided society. 95% of people in Northern Ireland go to religiously segregated schools. That's after 40 years of efforts to try and integrate the schools. At urban working class level, there's still a massive amount of segregation over where people live. So if you're a working class urban male in Northern Ireland, you will play a particular sport, you'll go to a particular school, and you'll live in a particular area. And you will not necessarily meet people of the other community. And that's a structural issue that really needs to be tackled. And there's no quick fix to that. That's a generational problem that needs a generational solution.
Nonetheless, for historian Dr. Ruth Dudley Edwards, life has been transformed in Northern Ireland.
Oh, it's been wonderful. I mean, there's no question about it. You didn't have to be searched every time you went into a shop. You didn't have no-go areas in the way you used to have. You felt happy going to a restaurant. You didn't have the random violence stuff. Been hugely, hugely popular at that sort of level, and people did vote for it. But there's this feeling among unionists that their identity is being chipped away, and they're very scared. And, you know, that breeds insecurity. But there's no question of how they feel. There was a recent poll where 47% of Northern Irish people said they didn't feel either unionist or nationalist. They want a functioning government. That's what they want. But when it comes to elections, they're driven into voting tribally because they will vote for the biggest party on their side in case the biggest party on the other side wins. And they feel there's no point in voting for the people and the moderates because they feel they won't get in. And that's an awful situation to be in.
One of the criticisms that's made of the Good Friday Agreement is that it institutionalised sectarianism.
Historian Professor Marion Elliott.
It's hard to know how you cannot do that. We will never get normal society in Northern Ireland until the powers that be recognise the underlying problem. It's a sectarian society. Even people who don't think they're sectarian, if you just scratch the surface, and that's why the troubles happened. If you just scratch the surface with one side, one community behaving like the stereotypes that you've been brought up with, it's enough just to ignite things. So yes, it does partly institutionalise sectarianism. And unfortunately, the two main parties have played on that. It's why they get such huge votes, because they know they can win elections. But you tell me, anybody that's put up anything that's better than the Good Friday Agreement, I don't know about it.
Britain and the EU say they've made significant progress on a Brexit deal, but the two parties are still at odds over the Irish border. The agreement reportedly includes a financial settlement, citizen rights and terms for a transition period. But the UK has described any deal that cuts Northern Ireland off from the rest of the United Kingdom as unacceptable.
A lot of people thought, well, you know, we've had the Good Friday Agreement, we've had peace 20 years ago, we're done and dusted, really. And I would say to people listening that look out for Brexit. Brexit potentially undermines a lot of the successes that have taken place. Because Brexit brings us right back to the point where we have to decide whether we're British or Irish. And the whole success of the Good Friday Agreement, it allowed us to park that final destination and just get on with the journey of living together, set up political institutions problematically, but we eventually set them up. They're currently in suspension because of the bad relationship between the main parties. But Brexit confronts us once again with the territorial sovereignty of Britain and Ireland. And the outcome of Brexit, if there's a hard border, potentially undermines the whole apparatus of the Good Friday Agreement by making it extremely clear to you which country you're living in. Whereas I had asked an Irish journalist a few years ago when I was writing a book, what's the best thing about the Good Friday Agreement? Is it the North-South bodies? Is it the power-sharing system, the clever geometry of this system in Northern? And he said, no, it's none of that. It's the motorway between Belfast and Dublin. Because that's the most tangible thing that people see in their everyday lives. And, of course, that means that you could live in Belfast and work in Dublin. Or you could live in Dublin and work in Belfast. And the concept of a border coming back will stop that happening. It'll make those journeys much more complicated and potentially then reduce that organic connection between the two sides where you don't really necessarily know which country you're in unless you've got some sort of sophisticated Google Earth going on. So Brexit potentially confronts us with the old argument, and that's why the Irish government and the British government, for that matter, are trying to sort of find some solution to it that doesn't reimpose a border, because that potentially then undermines a lot of the work that's been done over the last 20 years.
I do think the one thing that could reignite violence, and I don't see it as a strong possibility, but the one thing that could reignite violence in respect of Northern Ireland would be a reinforced border. Because who would want to be the first person putting up some sort of security installation, or, you know, even if it's just a customs monitoring unit anywhere near the border? I mean, that's in the Irish Republican heartland by and large anyway. You know, that's where the British found it almost impossible to police during the Troubles. Places like South Armagh on the border, they had to operate by helicopters and had huge watchtowers there. It's very, very difficult. So, you know, I don't think the British would risk putting up any sort of installations at the border. They know it's too risky. It would be utterly disastrous.
Despite the difficult border question thrown up by Brexit, the legacy of the Good Friday Agreement is a positive one. Fergal Cochrane.
I'm quite optimistic about the future, actually, because I think the underlying reasons for the conflict aren't there anymore. The underlying disparity in employment and housing conditions that spawned the civil rights movement in the 1960s, that's gone. The populations are actually now very, very close together in terms of their size. So the notion of a majority-minority relationship, that's starting to change as well. If you look at hotel building in Belfast, you know, they can't build hotels fast enough for tourists in Northern Ireland either. So there's a lot of really good positive signals coming out of the place. And the key to me is getting political structures established, because without those, everybody can just sit back and blame each other and then sort of retreat back into that sort of ethno-national sectarian mindset of it's everybody else's fault. But when we had the political institutions up and running, and for a period of 10 years, there was uninterrupted devolution in Northern Ireland. It wasn't always problem-free. But George Mitchell, the American senator who mediated the Good Friday Agreement, said at the end of it, he said, someday I wish I could come back with my son. He had a son born during the negotiations. And he said, oh, someday I would just like to come back with my son and sit in the visitor's gallery and listen to some boring debate about, you know, social policy. And on the 10th anniversary, I think it was, of the Good Friday Agreement, he did exactly that. He brought his son back. They sat in the gallery. They listened to some like dire debate about plastic bag taxes or something. And his son turned around to him and said, Dad, can we go? I'm really bored. And Mitchell said, at that point, I realized that my job was done.
Professor Fergal Cochrane, Director of the Conflict Analysis Research Centre at the University of Kent. You also heard John Tong, Professor of British and Irish Politics at the University of Liverpool, historians Dr. Ruth Dudley Edwards and Professor Marion Elliott, as well as Senator George Mitchell, who spoke to me 10 years ago for a Rear Vision on the 10th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. Isabella Tropiano is the sound engineer for this Rear Vision, and I'm Keri Phillips. Thanks for listening.